then they watched Trayvon Martin be killed, and Troy Davis be executed, and then Michael Brown's dead in the street, and then Tamir Rice is dead. And it was this reminder that a black president didn't erase the danger that came as an accessory of their black skin.
Coming up on In Contrast, why Black Lives Matter matters. Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowry. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Wesley Lowry is a journalist with the Washington Post. He was the lead reporter for the Post's Fatal Force, a Pulitzer Prize-winning project that tracked over 900 police shootings in 2015. He is the author of They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wesley Lowry, thank you for being on the show. I want to start with your engagement early on in the Ferguson story as a reporter for the Washington Post. How you came to be part of that story, in what way that early stage of what would become a movement, the movement of Black Lives Matter, shaped you.
So at the time of Ferguson, when Michael Brown was killed, August 9th, 2014, I was a political reporter. I was working for the Post. I covered Congress and national politics. I had some background and some interest in issues of justice and criminal justice, but really my job was to cover politics from D.C. And it really was kind of a twist of fate that I even ended up in Ferguson, Missouri. I had been reporting in Michigan on a congressional trip with a candidate for the days prior. I had happened to have a bag packed, and I got into the office and they said, hey, can you go to Missouri? We got this thing. People are upset, a protest, a police shooting. We just need to send somebody. Can you go? I thought about saying no. I had just gotten back on a trip. I was tired. I kind of had some laundry to do. But I said, you know what? Let's go. Let's get on the plane. Let's see how this works. I thought I'd be there for 3 days and ended up in Ferguson, Missouri for about 3 months, and now 3 years spent covering issues of policing and police policy and criminal justice policy. And so it's been fascinating as the arc of this story has developed, going from being a story about an individual place in suburban St. Louis to a story that's been about protest movement that gained kind of national legs, as well as what has certainly been a national conversation about race and policing and justice. As that has escalated and expanded, so has my portfolio of the work that I've been doing in this. And so I've had this unique opportunity to come in at a early chapter of a story and kind of write it out and stay with it as the story has changed and shifted.
And when you arrived at Ferguson, how did you start creating the connections with the various people that ended up being characters in this book that you would ultimately write, They Can't Kill Us All? And in what way did you feel pulled in one direction or the other because of the background that you had and the vision of what you were there to do?
Part of it just begins by being there. Many of the folks who I write about in this book or who have been covered or who've positioned themselves or been positioned as leaders in this kind of broader protest movement were just people who stepped outside of their houses. They wanted to see what was going on. They'd heard about the shooting. They were upset about it. And so they said, I'm not doing anything today. I'm going to go out to the protest. And thus was born a bunch of people who are now activists, who are mainstays of these demonstrations. And one of the big ways that I began building those relationships was just being out there with them, being there in the streets, asking questions, and then also trying to do that job in a way that was fair and honest. You know, one of the major tension points was you had this massive demonstration of people, times hundreds and thousands of people in the streets. And then you had these clashes with police. And very often the media, especially media that was not physically there, was left only with the police version of what had happened on that night. So the police put a press release out that says, look, there were these agitators, they did X, Y, and Z, and so on and so forth. Well, those reports and reporters who were relying only on that ended up writing very different things than those of us who were there and who were witnessing exactly what was happening. That's not to say that in every case the police were doing things they shouldn't have been doing or else, but that we had a different texture and understanding of what was going on in these on these evenings. And so because of that, many of these demonstrators saw, hey, whether I agree with everything you're writing or not, you're someone who's trying and working at doing this. Even when perhaps I write something that some of the activists don't agree with, they often do is they say, well, you know what? I trust you. You were there with us from the beginning. You were physically there. I know you wouldn't write something that you don't know to be true. There's a lot of currency that can be gained from people when you show that, look, I'm here with you. Tear gas is getting shot tonight. I'm going to be standing here putting the milk of magnesia in my own eyes as well. And then I'm going to start writing down what happened, right? I think that's important. I think people want journalists and reporters who are that committed to seeing what is really going on and who are willing to write that down.
Is there a difference between the reporters that are descending on a particular city, say Ferguson or Cleveland or Baltimore, and reporters that are local to that place and have had to tell stories and maybe the community will feel unhappy with the way they have reported, so on and so forth, the tension between national and local?
And there is certainly tension there. I've been on both sides of that. I've been a local reporter at times when there are big national stories and we're watching everyone else come into our city and write about these things. And I've now, for several years, been a parachute national reporter who shows up in your town to tell you about what's going on in your town. There are some tensions there. The first is that, you know, in many cases, you do have communities that are as deeply distrustful of their local media or of any media as they are of the police or the criminal justice system or so on and so forth. And so there can be a tension. There could be a feeling that perhaps the local press has not done its job, right, or is not covering some communities. Very often these incidents prompt a wave of quality, high-level coverage and attention, very often led by the local outlets. Yet there's a question very often, almost any story written after one of these incidents could have been written and published the day before, and why wasn't it? There's a question that could be asked about, well, why was there not reporting on these tactics happening the day before the child was killed in the street? That perhaps could have been preventative, right? If the local media is a structure and a system and institution that is to keep these local powers in check, you would hope that it's doing that work before the critical incident. A local outlet knows is a context that is different. When you physically live in a place, you don't forget to make the follow-up call on Tuesday. That after I've left, after my colleagues have left, you are still there asking questions, seeking accountability, answering things. I think that's important. So there's certainly attention in these moments, and there's certainly activists and residents who favor one outlet or the other. But, you know, I look at it less as a competition and I see it more as a complementary structure and system, right? I believe in mosaic of news. There was this old idea in journalism that I could parachute into a place and I could spend a day or two and I could figure out the story. I could get to 100% of the story. I could interview everyone. I could find everything and I could write this definitive voice of God thing. The reality is that was never true and remains not really true. That there are people who are going to talk to me only because of who I am or what I look like or because I connect with them or because of the outlet that I work for. And there are people who will never talk to me for those same reasons. And so I want as many journalists as possible getting their tidbit of the story. I got my 10% contribution and the LA Times gets their 10% contribution. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch gets their 30% contribution. And then woven all together, we've told the entirety of a story.
Of course, it's not a 10% or a 30%, because when you're writing for the Washington Post, you end up having a larger piece of the pie, or for the New York Times.
Sure. But there will always be angles you cannot cover, right? You know, an example of this would be there was a great story to be done in Ferguson, Missouri, for example, North County, St. Louis, on the municipal court system that I never did. My colleague Ryan Riley at the Huffington Post did that story, and it was a great story. And I was glad he did it. The fact that he did it meant there was a little less pressure on me to now do it. It exists. I can send it out to my followers. I can link to it. If more journalism is better, more quality journalism is better, then I think we have to divorce ourselves from this idea that, well, they did this story, so now I need to go do this story only a little bit better. It's sometimes I can just say, hey, you guys should read that great piece in the New York Times. They really got some good stuff there.
The book that you ended up writing, again, it's called They Can't Kill Us All, The Story of the Struggle for Black Lives, uses a lot of the reporting that you had already done in Ferguson and in Cleveland and in Baltimore, in other places. It expands it, it contextualizes it, it gives it space because this is a book. It also does something that I'm fascinated with, and that is that you insert yourself in a much more prominent way. And I want us to stay just for a little bit there. You tell your own story. At one point, you say about growing up, the product of a mixed race home. You also tell about the talk that some of your friends that are African American got of needing to be careful with the police. So I wonder if you can reflect for a little bit on the fact that you are of mixed race and that probably positions you in a kind of neutral place, or maybe it positions you in an impossible place because you're neither here nor there.
I hope that we're developing more understanding societally that reporters, journalists, are not these removed voices of God. It's a relatively recent innovation in American journalism that we would expect our news to be objective. This is largely a product of the last few decades and of the kind of academic structure being built around journalism. Previously, you would have a Republican paper and a Democratic paper in your town, and they would tell you why the other side was wrong about everything, and this is what the news really means, right? I don't know that I'd necessarily advocate such a partisan press that way. However, what I would say is I do think that there is value in understanding who your narrator is, and value in, as a narrator, as someone whose job it is to tell stories, in the transparency and the accountability that comes with being honest with my readers about who I am and where I'm coming from. When I get dispatched to Ferguson, Missouri, or Cleveland, Ohio, where I'm from, or Baltimore, or Charleston, I'm being dispatched as a 20-something-year-old black kid with a specific set of experiences who might be able to relate to certain people in this story more so than other people in this story. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't try to interrogate your own biases. That doesn't mean that you don't attempt to course correct for them or that you're not committed to fairness. But I think that we often build a fundamental dishonesty into the structure of how we do this when we pretend as if who we are and our own lived experiences don't affect the way we cover things or the zeal with which we cover things or the passion that we have for them. And so that's something that I kind of grapple with, is that I think that there's an advantage to being upfront about who you are, as opposed to trying to dig through your history and everything you've ever said to catch you in something. And, well, I already told you. You already know who I am.
I wonder if you wrestle also with having delivered to us readers who have you as a conduit, as the channel, as the bridge to those communities and to those stories, a sense that becoming an activist reporter might go too far, or that, on the other hand, is precisely what you want.
I think that any good reporter is an activist. And you should be an activist for a few specific things. If you are a reporter who's not an activist for the public's right to know, if you're a reporter who's not an activist for public transparency, if you're not a reporter who's an activist for people's rights and for First Amendment expression, if you're a reporter who's not an activist for equal treatment under the law and equality, I would argue you're abdicating your journalistic responsibility, right? I think that there is a world in which we do have to be willing to say there are some things by the very nature of our profession that we believe in. And one of those things, in my opinion, is that when an agent of the state kills someone in the street, the taxpayers have a right to know what happened. And they have a right to demand that information and receive it. At times there can become a discomfort, in part because by the nature of our job, by the nature of producing information, of being an institution that interacts with other institutions, we befriend the other institutions. We have to be able to divorce ourselves from that. On top of that, I think very often as reporters, we wed ourselves to the successes of the other institutions we cover. To be a police reporter with the police chief's cell phone number, well, the chief stops answering your calls, perhaps if you're calling him and saying, hey, why'd you guys kill that kid in the street today, right? The extent to which we are using the access we have can determine whether or not we retain that access. And I think that that struggle, that push and pull, often is what leads to coverage that I think communities find lacking or not correct. Now, there's obviously a difference between a reporter or a writer who is openly advocating for specific policy, who is openly advocating for specific outcome. I don't think I do that. It is true that, you know, I believe that there are reforms that are needed or would help limit the number of people being killed by the police. And it is true that I would like to live in a world where fewer people are killed by the police. Now, even 5 or 10 years ago, that would have been a radically crazy thing for a Washington Post reporter to be willing to say. But I think we have to acknowledge the reality we live in. Of course, I want fewer people being killed, right? You know, of course I believe that. And apply it to any other context. If your health reporter, your medical reporter said, look, I would like us to find a cure for cancer, you wouldn't go, well, you're not a fair, objective reporter. What about cancer's side of the story? We're humans. We live in a world where we should be allowed to accept that obviously there are some outcomes we think would be better for society, and we would like to work towards those outcomes.
There is an easy Manichaean approach that those that have been killed are people of color, blacks, Latinos, and those that have done the killing have been the police, and that the police is white. But your book and the story itself is far more complicated. So I wonder if you can reflect a bit on diversity within the police department and how the story changes when not only the reporter and not only the victim, but also the victimizer might be of the same race.
I think that we have to complicate our conversation about race, because I think very often we want a very specific, individualized black-white dynamic in order to believe that race is a factor or is not a factor, We believe that if an officer who shoots someone was black, then therefore race must not have factored into this conversation. Or the officer who is white, then race must have factored into this conversation. And part of that is because we interweave too often in our public conversation systemic and structural racism with individual prejudice, right? And those are two very different things. That race has the potential to enter an equation at any number of on-ramps. What is very likely the least often of those cases is someone's personal prejudice against someone else. But the neighborhood in which the police are policing, the tactics they apply to that neighborhood, the level of strictness or stringentness at the adherence of the law in that place versus somewhere else, the subconscious and unconscious biases that anyone, black, white, or any other color, might carry with them towards a person of color. All of these things are ways in which race can factor into a circumstance, whether the officer involved is white, black, or something else. And so I do think that very often we make a mistake with the focus on the white police officer who just shot the black man, because it simplifies this in a way that does not actually serve an honest conversation about this, right? There's very little data available on this because information about the officers who kill people is often kept private. But we've not found any evidence whatsoever that black officers are less likely to be shooting black suspects or unarmed black suspects. If I remember this correctly, the evidence we have suggests that black officers are more likely in some cases to be involved in these shootings of unarmed black people. Now, part of that might be the deployments, where an officer is being placed based on their experiences or their comfortability. What we know is that we have plenty of black officers shooting unarmed black people, as well as white officers and Latino officers. It's about a system and a structure within policing, not about the individual police officers themselves, rarely about the individual police officers themselves.
Would it have been different before your arrival to Ferguson? Said at the very beginning, you had had the opportunity of being a police officer for a week in one of those neighborhoods and experiencing firsthand what the police officers experience. And conversely, if you had not been a reporter, but you had also had a week to see the experience living in the actual neighborhood where some of these shootings would take place. I'm trying to see how the reporter is not only an observer that descends, you've been using the word parachuting, into these places, but the possibility of an actor in the theater in order to create his character lives within the body of either A or B, the characters that she is going to end up shaping.
So I think that's an interesting question. I mean, I've done police ride-alongs, but I'm trying to think about it in a world in which I had done this job. I mean, I think it unquestionably it would have changed some of my understanding of policing. I certainly had experiences much more closely to living in these neighborhoods than experiences of being a police officer. I think there's a grapple at the heart of journalism very often, where the role of a journalist, I think, is in many cases to hold powerful people and places and institutions to account, to ask hard questions, to demand accountability and transparency, while doing so in a way that is fair to those powerful people and institutions. Does that mean you have to completely understand the motivations of those powerful people and institutions? I don't know if it does. I don't know. In a story of power, I think there is value to the extent to which we can capture what powerful people are thinking and what their motivations are and what they say their motivations are. Yet I do think that there's a strand of journalism that is important that divorces itself from that completely. One could write a great book about school desegregation without interviewing any white people who threw bricks at buses. Academically and for historical purposes, is it valuable to talk to those people about their motivations and their desires? Certainly. And is it important to understand contextually what might have been going on in white ethnic enclaves at this time, or the feeling that access to education for black students might take away from, you know, a white immigrant experience? Look, I think those are things that are important to understand. But there's a danger at times of allowing our desire to understand to abdicate responsibility for behavior. You can understand why an officer is scared in a situation. You can understand the difficulties of policing day and night, or you can at least attempt to or acknowledge the parts of which you do not, while simultaneously saying, but now can you explain to me why this 18-year-old is dead in the street?
I find it interesting that you don't say that your reporting is also not only about holding those in power accountable, but in exploring the dilemmas of those that were powerless. Is the reporter also the one that will give voice to those that are voiceless and will try to understand the dilemmas of those that are voiceless? And is that also an audience that you are writing for, or you are writing for to hold accountable those that are in power?
I think it's both things. Now, I think that, again, you know, I'm a reporter who works in Washington on a newspaper that appears on the desk of the Oval Office every morning, right? And so there is, to some extent, an understanding that, you know, the ethos of some of the work that I do specifically is about accountability and about power. That said, a lot of the work I do, especially in the book, is about telling and complicating the stories of otherwise unheard people. No one is voiceless. The people of Ferguson were crying out about their policing for decades. We just didn't listen to them until there was a dead teenager in the streets. I certainly do think that there is something important about making sure people and the stories of these people are being told. And I think there is power in the telling of that for historical purposes, whether it changes anything in the moment or not. When you think of the tradition of writing down the experiences of Black people, historically in the United States of America, the experiences of Black people have always been disbelieved and discredited. The narrative of the benevolent slave owner. And yet there's been project after project historically that has provided us great value. You know, I was very recently in Louisiana at the Whitney Plantation, the only plantation museum in the United States of America that focuses on the experience of the slaves who lived on the plantation, as opposed to the look at this architecture and this beautiful type of museum. And one of the major components of this is they have a roster and a listing of every enslaved person who was housed on this plantation. And in some cases, they have the histories, oral histories that had been done by academics. So these enslaved people talking in their own words about what their experiences were in this place. Those enslaved people giving those interviews were not going to end slavery. If only I could find a slave to interview and then everyone will know this is terrible. That was never going to be what happened, right? However, the existence of these narratives, of these stories being written down, forces us now at a different era in history to not be able to deny those experiences. We could hear from the slaves themselves about what happened. I think a lot about Ida B. Wells's work and how she documented lynchings. I have a hard time believing that Ida B. Wells woke up each morning and thought, I'm going to report and write about that lynching yesterday, and then everyone's going to read about this in the newspaper and say, hey, that was a terrible thing we did. We should never do that again. But what she did was she created a historical ledger of real things that happened so that we cannot ever deny them ever again. And so I don't know the extent to which some of this reporting and some of this writing makes a difference in some of these local communities. I do think that there is a world in which when the Washington Post calls the mayor of your small town, they answer the questions the Washington Post asks very often. And I think there's a way that we can force some transparency and accountability through the platform we have. But I do think that some of the greater value in this work is writing down people's experiences so history will know what people experienced.
There is a moment early on in your book, I think it's in the prologue, and I believe it takes place in Ferguson, please correct me if I'm wrong, where you yourself are arrested. You're a journalist, you are telling the police officers that you're a journalist and that they should know this, and still they go on and you don't end up in jail for a long time, but you are now one of those that the police is after. Could you walk me through that moment and could you reflect on it? And I'd like to see why you chose to have that at the very beginning of the book.
The anecdote essentially is, this is my second or third day in Ferguson. Myself and a colleague are reporting on the protests that are happening during the day. And most of the demonstrations in Ferguson happened on West Florissant Street. Now, West Florissant is a thoroughfare that has kind of strip malls lining it, kind of a business sector, and people would march up and down. One of the things you learn when you travel a lot for reporting is to find McDonald's and Starbucks, because McDonald's and Starbucks always have outlets and they have free Wi-Fi. You need a place where you can plug in, charge your phone, and do your writing. There was McDonald's in West Florissant about 3 or 4 blocks up from where Michael Brown was killed. And so it became this newsroom. You could walk in at a given hour and see journalists from every outlet who are in there working, ordering food, talking about it. And so myself and Ryan are in there, and there's this moment where a SWAT team comes into the restaurant. And they say, hey, everybody should get out of here. Some protests are getting dicey up the street. Maybe everyone should leave. And so we say, hey, are you telling us we got to leave? Or are you just, they're like, no, we think you should leave. And I'm like, all right. And they come back a few minutes later and they say, no, now we're ordering you to leave. Everyone's got to get out. And so myself and Ryan, we start this process of kind of packing up our stuff. And the officers eventually get frustrated. They don't think we're moving quickly enough. And so as I'm walking towards the door, they grab me and arrest me. At this point, dozens, if not hundreds of demonstrators, residents had been arrested during protests. But Ryan and I were the first two journalists to be detained during this ordeal. Some of our fellow journalists realized or saw what happened and started asking questions, started tweeting about it, started making phone calls, and they're saying, hey, what's the deal? What's going on? This ultimately became a flashpoint in this story. The two of us were arrested, and this prompted a kind of a massive outrage among the journalism community. At the time, Attorney General Eric Holder and President Obama both addressed it publicly and decried our arrests. Later that evening, Antonio French, who was an alderman in the city of St. Louis and who had been acting as a citizen journalist, also was detained. We came this moment where we were unquestionably thrust into the story. Now, it was remarkably unpleasant, not because we were deeply mistreated or anything like that, but because, one, we are here to write about something, and now we have this massive impediment to it. We're, one, I'm literally in the jail cell instead of out in the street interviewing people. But two, we've become characters in the story in a way that is uncomfortable. We became punching bags. You know, we had cable news hosts taking pot shots at us. Or, you know, we personally became up for critique. I don't love talking about it because I thought it was always kind of tangential and it can distract from the larger story. I'd spent a lot of time interviewing people and doing work I was really proud of in Ferguson. I thought that sometimes that overshadowed it. In writing the book, I felt as if it would have been disingenuous to not acknowledge early on people are picking it up because they remember me as that guy who got arrested in McDonald's. That rather than drop this in somewhere randomly in the middle of the book, let's dispense of this early. Yes, I'm that guy who you remembered. Because in many ways, this is a story not of me, but it's a story of how this broader protest movement, how this narrative in journalism and media advanced beyond Ferguson, where I'm a bit character in the rest of the story. But this isn't a story about me and my coverage of this thing. This is a story about the people of Ferguson and the young activists in Cleveland and Charleston and Baltimore. And that was important to me to get myself out of the way. Again, not to conceal. This is who I am. This is what happened. I was there. I was that guy. Let's clear the air on that. Now that we've dealt with that, let's talk about some journalism.
I find it fascinating. You were talking earlier on of the fact that institutions, the police, the media, relate to one another, interact, and sometimes will overlap or fight with each other. One gets the sense that in the media, people don't see themselves as an institution, or at least there's a certain reluctance to conceive of the media, though the rest of the country and others would see it as an institution. There's a kind of bipolar aspect there.
Part of that stems from this kind of journalism objectivity, we are not the story training that most working journalists have gone through, that we're never allowed to acknowledge our own existence. And I think that creates, at times, inaccurate or at least tone-deaf coverage. If CNN shows up at a vigil, the dynamics of the vigil have changed because now Anderson Cooper is standing on the corner. People who might have been marching are now taking selfies with Anderson Cooper. People who might have gone home are now standing and doing things for the benefit of the camera. Our presence changes stories. The way we cover a story changes stories. If you have someone who gets caught in a pseudo-controversy, someone who tweets something wrong or gets caught in a viral video doing something dumb, the fact that we are calling their employer and saying, hey, have they been disciplined? In fact, probably makes it more likely they will be disciplined than if no one had ever called their employer, right? The media is an institution that interacts with the things that we are supposed to be documenting, and by that interaction, facilitate change or different outcomes. That's not to say that I think we need to be coordinated in how we do these things or working towards an agenda, but I do think that we should at least acknowledge the fact that we play a role in these things. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reluctance to do that. We see this right now in the conversation about the presidential election all the time, where there is a reluctance among some political reporters to acknowledge that perhaps some of the ways we covered the candidate who won, as well as some of the ways that we covered the candidate who lost, might have helped shape those outcomes in the first place, right? So we have this conversation very often in a context about whether it be Hillary Clinton's emails or about the amount of times where the time candidate Trump was able to just talk and talk and talk on television forever and say whatever he wanted to do. We're running his campaign rallies live on TV.
Just as you were saying that the role of the media or of the journalist is to call power into its own limits, the question one often asks is who calls the media to see how far and or how dangerous it has gone in delivering a story. There's no policing of the media?
Policing of the media happens almost entirely internally, us talking to ourselves and each other, which can become problematic when we know the demographics of the media are not necessarily reflective of the demographics of the country. I do think that social media has changed some of that. We can get more direct feedback from our viewers and our readers. I also think that It's difficult because we in the media have conditioned ourselves not to pay attention to the feedback from our readers. It's a well-known adage that you never read the comments on an article. You ignore most of your reader email or mail. Like, oh, that's just the crazies. Or, of course, that's racist. Or, of course, well, that cuts in two directions. The first is if you teach yourself to ignore your readers and their feedback of your readers, then you're not going to be building the relationships with them over time to gain trust and credibility. But second, it allows us to be delusional about who our readers are and what they care about. You know, there was a line of conversation not long after the presidential election where many people would say, can you just believe so many people weren't turned off by whether it be xenophobic language or racist ideas or, you know, and I said, yes, because I hear from those people every single day. They're in my inbox. We can't write an article about a new litter of puppies at the shelter without the third internet comment getting racist. Well, if that's the truth, you know, we accept that to be true, but at the same time want to say, well, but no, this country can't have some massive racism issue. Of course, we can't write anything on the internet ever without like this immediately devolving into this. We allow ourselves to live in a bubble sometimes that is dishonest.
I want to ask you about how you came to understand that the killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, one of many, many by the police, was the beginning of a movement or of an ideology that was taking shape, Black Lives Matter. But before you do that, I wonder if I can stop and ask you to reflect semantically on how you use the word story. When does an event that happens somewhere become a story worth covering? And at what point the story becomes larger than the story? It connects with other stories that will snowball into shaping an entire movement.
We make a mistake when we force a given news event into a specific story. This is the story versus that is the story, or you're making yourself the story. Stories are multi-sided. The story of Hurricane Harvey is as much the story about the prison inmates who are left in the prison during the hurricane as it is the rescue operations, as it is the story of the mayor, as it is the story of what the Army Corps of Engineers was doing. And you can't deny the import of any of those individual stories or narratives. As it relates to this movement or this conversation, there was a moment very early on where you could tell that the people on the ground in Ferguson, Missouri, were not lying when they said they were going to be out again the next day. I'd covered, not a lot, but I'd covered some police shootings previously, and I had colleagues who had as well who I'd talked to. And very often after a shooting, you see a vigil and you see a gathering of people and you hear these pledges, well, you know, we're not going to let this get swept under the rug. We're going to stay out here every day till there's justice. And then by day 4 or 5, everything has kind of moved on. What was different was that in those first days and then first month, you had more than 100 days of continuous protests in Ferguson. People stayed in the streets. Their presence necessitated the media to be there, which necessitated the police to be there, which perpetuated itself. That there was an insistence by the people of Ferguson, the resident of Ferguson, that I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to keep doing this. That, I think, is what changed this from so many of the other cases.
And how did this become Black Lives Matter? As we enter the second half of Donald Trump's first year, is Black Lives Matter a story of the end of the Obama years? Is it still feasible? Does it still have legs? Should we start looking at it as another chapter of the civil rights movement that prolonged itself into this century, but just the chapter that has concluded?
I think that we're still seeing the story play out. I actually think the Obama years ushered in this moment of Black Lives Matter, of this movement, of this focus and so intently on these issues. We have to remember that this doesn't exist or happen in a vacuum in any capacity. First, there was work that was happening in these spaces previously, even if we were not all discussing them constantly. And in fact, we were discussing some of this work, right? There was, prior to Black Lives Matter, you had massive conversations about stop and frisk, for example. Major media narratives and conversations we were having about issues of equity and criminal justice. Conversations about mass incarceration and, you know, the new Jim Crow. There has been conversation about this, even if it was not the leading domestic news story every single day. What I do think was unique about this moment was that President Obama was a unique figure in that he had forced a mainstreaming of a conversation about race that had been secondary during the years of his predecessors. By his very presence and very nature, he gave us a comparison point to other presidents previously and how he was being treated differently, both rhetorically and in terms of policy, and we could see that. It made palatable the differences between being a black president and a white president in the United States of America. I think it was Jelani Cobb for The New Yorker who wrote or said once that we needed to have a black president to understand the limitations of a black presidency. The president was elected on a wave of hope and change, or this idea that, yes, we can. We are this uniting force that we are going to overcome the inequities of our society. And by his election and then the reaction to his election, President Obama clearly identified the limitations of that rhetoric and showed, in fact, how much more space and time there was to accomplish these things. So what was interesting to me was that I thought that many of the young activists who've become prominent in recent years, the types of people who voted for Barack Obama, some of whom canvassed for Barack Obama, young black political types, this was their first election or their first time voting, and who believed that they could work within the system to create a better, more equitable world. And then they watched Trayvon Martin be killed and Troy Davis be executed. And then Michael Brown's dead on the street. And then Tamir Rice is dead. And it was this reminder that a black president didn't erase the danger that came as an accessory of their black skin.
Didn't erase it, but inadvertently exacerbated it?
I think it inadvertently created an awareness that perhaps had not existed.
What do we do with that awareness? Now that there is no more black president, now there's one that, as has been said, is the first white president because Donald Trump's approach is to negate everything that was done by the black president. What do we do with the awareness of what happened in those past few years? Are we better off realizing the limitations of a black president? Not that I want to go back in time, but I want to know, what is it that we can use to process to take us to another place?
I think we're always better off to tell the truth in public. I think that we are in a better world if it is a world in which we can acknowledge inequities and in which black and brown people are empowered to tell their truths. I think we are better in that world than in a world in which we pretended that we existed in a post-racial society. I think that many people have more clarity about the extent to which forces of prejudice and racism run rampant in our nation than they did 8 years ago. It's unfortunate that that awareness has to come at the expense of the Obama presidency, that you have to have a black man be attacked publicly for 8 years in order for people to say, well, I guess maybe you're right, racism does exist. However, I think that in moving forward and having these conversations in both policy and rhetorical spaces, I think it is helpful for us to have that clarity and be able to speak that clarity. And so I think there's an open question of how we move forward and what happens next, and to the extent at which we should be optimistic or pessimistic about what happens next. At times, especially in the early Obama years, there was a feeling of inevitable change for the better. And I think that it is a good thing that we no longer assume that, because it was never true. What remains to be seen is what actually happens next, if there is change for the better, or if this continues to be a slide backwards.
You are not being a pessimist. You're saying, I'm a realist. That was there. There is possibility for improvement, but we will see where we go.
Yeah. We can't solve a problem we can't name. And so, you know, we see this a lot of times with polling. One thing that people would like to beat Obama up on was they'd say, you'd look at it's a Pew poll and it's this number of, how do you think race relations are in the country? How would you assess, are they getting better or getting worse? And during the Obama years, people's idea of race relations, more people were saying they thought race relations were getting worse. That's not necessarily a gauge of whether or not race relations were getting worse. It's a gauge of people's perceptions of a reality, right? Just because people didn't realize that relations were bad and now they do. It's not the invention of a new problem, right? I would stake out the position that I think that us knowing and being able to accurately assess our reality is a good step towards addressing it.
It has been extraordinary to have you as a guest in the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The roots of Black Lives Matter go back to the slave trade, in which approximately 12.5 million Africans were brought to the New World between 1525 and 1866. 10.7 million of them survived the journey known as Middle Passage, with over 300,000 landing in North America. In 1862, President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation ended a shameful chapter in U.S. history. But inequality didn't disappear overnight. In fact, it is intrinsic in our society. There is no question that Blacks, Latinos, and other minorities are treated differently, especially by authority figures. This inequality must be fought relentlessly for the country to live up to its original mandate in the Declaration of Independence, that all of us are created equal with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Police brutality doesn't only pertain to the civilian and the police officer who suddenly become actors in the same ancient drama. It defines us all. The police represent not only a handful, but every member of society. Their mandate is to safeguard order, but it doesn't need to be performed through violence. Instead, it should be performed with empathy and compassion. It is a well-known fact that police are often brought into situations for which they are ill-prepared. A large number of incidents of police brutality involve cases of mental illness. Solving those cases with a gun is the wrong approach. The movement of Black Lives Matter matters because it showcases the degree to which education is fundamental to bring about change. Racism against one individual is racism against all. Inequality remains at the core of the American project. And until we confront it through knowledge, honest, courageous, the shameful legacy of slavery will remain an obstacle on the road to true equality. Next time on In Contrast, being a conservative in the age of Trump.
And in order to disagree well, you have to understand well. That means you have to understand the position of your opponents before you can even attempt to knock them down, which is one reason why people who really feel that they want to defeat the conservatives of the world ought to be the ones most intent on listening to them.
Brett Stevens, next time on In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook. Our interns include Isabel Myers, Jacob Pagano, Ian Petty, and Ushi Shao. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.